As my title indicates, I'm going to be arguing against what has become a settled orthodoxy in philosophy generally, and in political philosophy in particular, and that is that groups of people or collectives can be agents that can be responsible for what they do and therefore liable for what they do. I'm going to be discussing structured or organized collectives such as corporations or states. And so whenever I refer to collectives, I mean to be referring to structured or organized collectives. But if what I have to say about those collectives is right, it should apply also to unstructured collectives as well. Let me begin by saying it is certainly true that we talk about collectives as agents and as having many or most of the psychological capacities possessed by human agents or single human person agents. We commonly ascribe desires, beliefs, intentions, emotions, and interests to collectives. And because these collectives are thought to have interests, they are also thought to be capable of being benefited and harmed. It's assumed, or in some cases argued for, that these collectives can be responsible agents that can have duties or obligations, and that can also, as I mentioned earlier, be responsible for what they do, liable for what they do, liable to certain kinds of action, defensive, or liable to pay compensation to victims. And it's also assumed that they can be deserving of harm if they are culpable in their action. It's also widely assumed that agents, in particular the state, can have moral status. So, for example, Michael Walzer says that states, I'm quoting here, possess rights more or less as individuals do. And this way of thinking and talking about collectives is, in fact, consistent with the way that collectives and states in particular have traditionally been understood in just war theory. So I'm going to say just a tiny bit about the way that collectives have been understood in just war theory, what the moral implications of this have been thought to be, and I will go on from there to discuss more familiar doctrines of collective responsibility, which, as you'll see, I think are quite different from the doctrine, the collectivist doctrines that we find informing the traditional theory of the just war. So one recurrent device in theorizing about just war is what Michael Walzer called the domestic analogy. The domestic analogy is the idea that states are, in fact, individuals, analogous to individual persons with analogous properties such as autonomy and the other psychological attributes that I mentioned a moment ago. And more importantly, that the same moral principles that govern the conduct of individuals in relations with one another also govern the conduct of states in their relations. And you find this in international law as well, the subjects of which are states and not individual persons. Traditional just war theory draws a range of implications from the domestic analogy in conjunction with a conception of war according to which, as Rousseau puts it, war is something that occurs not between man and man, but between states. So states are the primary agents in war, and they are collectives. So here I'm going to mention just two of the main implications that just war theorists have drawn from the idea that war is a relation between states and that states are individuals whose action is governed by the same kind of moral principles that govern the action of individual persons. First, in war, membership in the state by individuals limits individual responsibility and liability. So membership in the state is something like a shield against responsibility or liability. And you see this both in the way that non-combatants are understood and the way that combatants are understood. So despite their many economic and political contributions to war, civilians are thought to be exempt from responsibility for unjust wars. And they are exempt also from liability for unjust wars and for unjust acts of war, however much they may have contributed causally in their role as civilians. And similarly, combatants are exempt from responsibility for fighting in an unjust war, and they are also exempt from punishment for fighting in an unjust war and doing things in the course of an unjust war that would otherwise be criminal. And these exemptions are based primarily on the idea that responsibility for an unjust war lies with the state, that is, with the collective, and that responsibility does not transmit to individual persons who are the members of the states, apart from perhaps some members of the government who are seen as the primary agents of the state. Second main implication, after the implication that membership in the state limits responsibility and liability, is that membership in the state is thought to expand the permissions that individuals have. It expands the range of what is permissible for individuals to do. And again, the most salient example of this is that membership in the state is supposed to make it permissible for combatants to kill morally innocent people in pursuit of aims that are unjust, which is a difficult thing to claim is it's permissible to do. Nevertheless, that is what just war theory says. And various explanations have been offered that appeal to the relation between individual combatants and the state. One of these efforts at justification claims that the state has a duty to protect its citizens. It has a duty to protect all of its citizens. And what this means is that when its citizens fight on behalf of the state and expose themselves to risk and danger in that way, they are permitted by their state to shift most of the costs of their action onto others, including innocent civilians on the other side. They are supposed to be able to give themselves a certain degree of priority over the civilian population of the state against which they are fighting. It's not a limitless priority, but there is some priority. And the justification is supposed to be they are authorized by their state to take care of themselves because it's the state's duty to care for them. So they are fulfilling the duty of the state to protect its own citizens when they do this. I think this is a mistake. I don't think that this kind of thing is possible, and you'll see how it's a mistake if you consider, to borrow Walzer's term, a domestic analogy, that is, an analogy with a situation from individual life outside the context of war. You can imagine that somebody has a responsibility to protect me. Maybe a policeman, or maybe my mother, or somebody like that has a responsibility to protect me, and whoever that person is has to send me off on a dangerous errand. And they tell me, look, I've got a duty to protect you. When you get in danger, shift the cost to other people, not to yourself, because only in that way will you be fulfilling my duty to protect you. And as Ray recognizes, that there can't be a permission of that sort conferred on me by this other person, whatever that person's responsibilities with respect to me are. A second common argument among just war theorists is that the expanded range of individual permissions can be created via democratic decision making, which is the way in which...
Okay.
This is probably a test that you
it's a
do
test
with
that
all.
Every Tuesday.
No, no, it's a test it's for the speakers. Yeah, I was just see how brave we are, whether we rush for the door. I'm glad I passed the test. The idea here is that the proper way of making the morally legitimate way of making decisions about whether or not to go to war is through democratic decision making processes, and when the operation of such democratic procedures results in a decision to go to war, that provides sufficient authorization for combatants to make it morally permissible for them to fight, even if the war turns out to be unjust. Now, again, I think that can't work either. I think it's clearly true that people within a group can, by reaching agreement with one another, create permissions for one another with respect to what they can do to other members within the group. So, for example, the members of a club can elect a disciplinary officer who is authorized to discipline members when they violate the rules or whatever, and in that way, new permissions are actually created. What I deny is that by banding together people and deliberating and making agreements among themselves, people can create permissions for their members to harm people who are outside the group and are not party to the agreement. And again, we can illustrate this in a very easy, simple way to show why this familiar and common idea in just war theory won't work in the case of war. We can just imagine that, you know, for example, those of us in this room, we can imagine we're all stateless individuals, and we exist in this room for a while, but we petition the United, we buy some territory, we petition the United Nations, we become a state, and we're recognized, and then we become a democratic state, and we duly elect Tom and authorize him to, we elect him president, we authorize him to commit us to going to war when he wants to. And you can imagine, before we became a state, none of us had any permission to go kill people in the neighboring state. And maybe it's England. We might be like Lesotho inside of a larger state, England. Before that, we had no permission to kill anybody in England. But now, with our democratically authorized president declares war on England, and those of us who constitute the military now, according to traditional just war theory, are supposed to be permitted to go kill people in England because we're going to go make war against them. Not very wise, but nonetheless, that's what Tom has ordered us to do. So we do it. We're acting permissibly, even if we're acting foolishly. And again, you can see, it's evident, we can't conjure up a permission for ourselves to go kill people that we didn't have antecedently just by engaging in elections and voting to go kill people. It's just not possible. And this whole idea should be suspect in any case, because traditional just war theory concedes that states have no permission to fight unjust wars. And so they don't have a permission that they can transfer to their agents in the first place. So again, the permission has to be conjured up de novo by people through a process of election or something like that, which is just it's alchemy. It doesn't work. Okay, so that's all I really wanted to say about just war theory. What I mainly wanted to mention just war theory in order to contrast it with more familiar understandings of collective agency and collective responsibility. Because according to doctrines of collective responsibility that I imagine most of you are familiar with, membership in a collective has exactly the opposite effects that just war theory says it does. So it says that membership in a collective expands the range of individual responsibility and liability rather than contracting it, but that it diminishes the range of individual permissions. So, for example, an individual's mere membership in a collective can make it permissible for others to harm him when it would otherwise have been impermissible for them to do so. That's an important implication of most understandings of collective responsibility. So I'll go on to discuss these views, the more familiar views about collective responsibility, but Let me just make an observation at the outset, which you may think is it is unsubstantiated at this point, but it was something that struck me when I was reading over the notes that I had converted into the notes for this talk. And that is the contrast between the collectivist ideas in traditional just war theory and more familiar doctrines of collective responsibility shows just how easy it is to exploit these notions of collective agency and so on for whatever purposes one has in mind. I think that's because claims about group agency, responsibility, and liability tend to conjure up really rather vague ideas, both in those who make these claims and in those to whom the claims are addressed. And so they are susceptible to deployment when people are groping for support for some intuitive judgments about problems that are deeply puzzling. And they can give the illusion that the puzzles have yielded or been solved. And I'll give you just one quick example from my own experience, and that is that in recent years I have been doing a bit of work on the problem of proportionality in defense in cases in which a very large number of threateners each make a tiny contribution to some very substantial harm. What are these people liable to when they're each making only a very tiny contribution? And when I give talks on this, I'm surprised to find how often now people say or readily say, but if you just regard, for example, you know, one of the paradigm examples in the area is Parfit's harmless torturers. If some of you know the example of the harmless torturers, if you don't worry about it. Some people say, well, if you just regard the harmless torturers as together constituting a group agent, the problems just disappear. Well, they don't actually disappear. In fact, as far as I can tell, that doesn't do anything to help. But some people get the illusion that they've come to grips with the problem if they can just say, it's actually a group. And in that way, we can figure out what the liability of the individuals is. Okay, just as background to what I'm going to say, let me mention that there are three different ways in which individuals who are members of a collective might be thought to be implicated by a claim about collective responsibility. And you find all of these claims in the literature. It may be helpful just to distinguish three initially so you'll have them in mind. One claim, which is perhaps the most common, is that when a collective is responsible for some outcome, the responsibility is transmitted to the individual members, all of the individual members of the collective. I think the term that collective responsibility theorists use is that the responsibility distributes. It distributes to the individual members. Some say it distributes equally, some say unequally, as we'll see. Another way in which individuals can be implicated in responsibility and liability through membership in a collective is that, or is claimed to be, that by virtue of co-membership in a group, one individual can become responsible and liable for what another individual does, even though the one individual has no causal input in what the other does whatsoever. It's by virtue of co-membership that the one individual becomes responsible. That's not really a claim so much about collective responsibility as it is about complicity within a group, but it's a idea in the family of ideas that go under the heading of collective responsibility. Finally, a third way is that, and there may be more, but these are the most commonly discussed ways, a third way in which individuals may be implicated is indirect, and that is some people claim that collective responsibility stays with the collective. It does not distribute or transmit to other individuals. On the other hand, as we'll see, what is often the case is that in doing what is said to be harming a collective or collecting costs from a collective, individual members of the collective are the ones who actually suffer the things that are obviously describable as harms. And the notion of harm to the collective, I think, looks to me more metaphorical than anything else. And the real harms get suffered by individuals who are the members of the collective. So even when responsibility is not thought to distribute to individuals, there is, in any case, a claim that it becomes permissible to do to the collective what will in fact harm the individuals, and that's permissible because of collective responsibility. So what I want to do mostly is to repeat for you some of the things that theorists of collective responsibility have said in support of these doctrines. And the first thing that they need to say is that there really are such things as collectives. In order for there to be something that's responsible, there's got to be the collective. And there are greater and lesser degrees of reification of collective entities in the literature, but even someone like Philip Pettit, whose view I think of as a very kind of moderate collectivist view, insofar as he sees collectives as in certain ways, reducible to individual agents. And he's also one of the theorists who sees collective responsibility as not distributing to individuals. It stays at the level of the collective, both of which I think make his view more plausible than most. Even he thinks that collectives do have their own reality. They do have their own psychological attributes. And he gives cases involving majoritarian voting, in which the members of a collective vote in certain ways, then submit their votes to a collective decision-making procedure and get results that are actually at variance with the attitudes and preferences of every single member of the collective. And what he says is that this shows that the group's attitudes and judgments are, as he puts it, functionally independent of the attitudes and judgments of the members that make up the collective. And he then says that this shows that the attitudes and judgments of the members are novel and distinct. Therefore, there must be a novel and distinct agent who has those attitudes and judgments. And what I think about this is that when I read Philip's descriptions of what's going on, that is, there are these people, they have attitudes and preferences, they submit their attitudes and preferences via voting to some decision-making procedure, that is, they have some rules that they follow in determining what they're going to do on the basis of their attitudes and preferences and so on. And then the decision-making procedure generates certain directives or prescriptions, and then they then do what the decision-making procedure has told them they should do. I think when Philip describes all of these facts, I think he's just described all the facts. And when he then makes further claims about the collective agent and so on, the fact that the decision-making procedure yields results that differ from the attitudes and preferences of the individuals shouldn't be surprising. That's something that it's predictable that you could get given the nature of the rule that they've decided to follow. And so when he and others make claims about the group agent and the group attitudes and group preferences and so on, I think what they're doing is they're adding a further layer of description, but they're not actually describing any further facts. They're not describing any facts that haven't already been described when the facts about the individuals and their relations and so on have been described. And of course, I do think that this collectivist language is unavoidable. We have to use it, and that's because the relevant facts about individuals and their relations are far too numerous for us to mention. We need some form of shorthand in discussing what goes on. And often we don't, in fact, almost always, particularly in the case of complex collectives like a state, Nobody knows all the facts. Nobody knows all the relevant facts, but we have a good sense of the tendency of the facts that we know, and then we just say things like, the Bush administration was determined to go to war in Iraq, or the United States intended to fight a war in Iraq, or something like that. So, talking in this way, ascribing mental states to collectives and treating them as agents in our discourse is unavoidable. There's nothing wrong with it. But I think it can be both misleading and pernicious. And there was an article in the New York Times, I forget when, a year or two ago, by one of the leading experimental philosophers, Josh Knobe at Yale, in which he provided some very, to me, disturbing evidence about how misleading and pernicious this way of talking is. That is, he and his colleagues did some studies that showed that even though people, when you ask them, know that collectives like Apple or Google or whatever aren't conscious entities like persons, and don't themselves have emotions the way that you and I have emotions, and don't have beliefs in the way that you and I have beliefs. They know that they don't have minds. Nevertheless, when you ask people questions about collectives, and you mention these attributes that we commonly ascribe to them, that Apple has an interest in this, and Apple wanted to do this, and Apple's aim was this, that, and the other thing, people think about the collective in exactly the same way they think about persons. And their reactive attitudes are the same. And what that means is, in practice, if they would be angry at an individual to whom this description applies, or resentful against an individual to whom a certain description applies, and you perhaps even accurately give that description of some collective, like a corporation, they will feel anger and resentment against the corporation, which includes all the individuals who are in it. And so the emotion kind of diffuses outward and covers all the individuals. So I'm adding a little more there than you'll find in Josh's piece in the New York Times, but nevertheless, that's the disturbing tendency, psychological tendency, that I think goes with our ordinary ways of talking about collectives. So the question for me is, if it's right that the descriptions are really just an additional layer of description, they're not actually pointing to facts that exist over and above the facts about individuals and their relations. That is, if I'm right in asserting a reductionist interpretation of these claims, what is supposed to be the advantage of the additional layer of description? Well, the theorists do think that there is an important advantage, or rather an important set of advantages to talking this way and thinking this way about collectives. And in my reading of the literature, which is admittedly limited, the concern that seems to me to lie behind most of what's said in the literature, particularly on collective responsibility, not so much collective agency, that kind of thing, you know, the metaphysics and epistemology and so on, but moral and political motivation for wanting to recognize collective responsibility seems to me primarily to be a concern for the compensation of victims of collective wrongdoing. You find that as a persistent theme in the literature. For example, Annie Stills has an important paper about collective responsibility, and she writes that, I'm quoting now, "squeamishness about implicating individuals who have not chosen to join the state," where "join" there is in quotation marks, "who have not chosen to join the state seems rarefied when we turn our attention to the uncompensated wrongs perpetrated by states in their victims' names. And this claim is made in support of her conclusion that civilians can be liable to pay reparations to the victims of their state's unjust war, even if they have made no contribution of any sort to the war, and even if they have actively opposed the war. What she says in this case is that each civilian's liability may derive from the state's acts, not his personal acts. So this is a way in which all the citizens in a state get implicated in the wrongdoing of the state and are therefore liable, in her view, to compensate victims. The same concern is explicit in the writings of another well-known collectivist, David Miller, a political philosopher. He says that when groups cause harm, it's imperative that there should be a fair distribution of costs. And what he goes on to say is, but when groups act in these ways, we don't know what the contributions of different individuals are. And he goes on to say, even if we knew exactly what each individual contributed, we still wouldn't know how to assign responsibility and liability on the basis of our knowledge about each person's contributions. So what he says is that, I'm quoting now, our starting point must therefore be that the group is collectively responsible and that every participant bears an equal share of that responsibility. This is a very strong doctrine of collective responsibility, and it's based primarily on epistemic limitation. He says, well, we just can't know the relevant facts, so what we've got to do is just treat everybody as equally responsible, because that's the only way we're going to get victims compensated. We've got to achieve the fair distribution of costs. And the background problem here is one that is discussed at great length by many of the most important theorists of collective responsibility. I'm going to focus here primarily on Annie Stills, but everything that I find in Annie's work is present in some form or other in Philip Pettit's work as well. And they actually have synonymous terms for the problem that I think motivates them morally and politically to want to embrace a doctrine of collective responsibility. Philip's term is that in cases of harm, large harms to a large number of people caused by collective agents, there is a deficit of responsibility for the harm. And Annie's term is that there is a responsibility shortfall. So they're both making the same claim, and they both have parallel examples. It's very curious. Philip has the example of a passenger ship company that operates in accordance with shoddy procedures, and the passenger ship sinks, and a lot of people are killed. He has a real-life case. Annie has a hypothetical case of an airline company that runs on the basis of shoddy procedures, and the airplane crashes. And what they both say is, looks like there's a shortfall of responsibility here for various reasons that I'm going to suggest. And they both say, and David Miller says, it makes sense to hold the collective itself responsible. And he says, and it makes sense also, it's wise to the phrases that they use. They say, it makes sense to hold them responsible, and it's wise to hold them responsible. They don't just say they are responsible for this reason, and you'll see why. I mean, it makes sense because this is the only way we're going to get the victims compensated. Now, I think there's a real danger here. You may think this is intuitively plausible. Yes, there have been all these victims of the action of people in this collective, and the only way we're going to get victims compensated is to get the collective as a whole to pay the compensation. And so we're going to do that. One thing that I think that these theorists have not confronted is the view, which is my view, that the basis for liability to paying compensation ex post is exactly the same as the basis for liability to defensive action ex ante. So if I've caused harm and I'm liable to compensate the victims, I was in principle liable to an equivalent harm, or perhaps an even greater harm, beforehand to prevent me from doing what would cause the harm. And so it's not, the implications of views about collective responsibility aren't just for duties of compensation. There are also implications about liability to defensive harming in advance of the action. And those implications are harder to accept. And that's because compensation ex post is normally paid through financial means, whereas defensive action involves physical harms to people to prevent them from imposing the costs in the first place. As far as I know, none of these collective responsibility theorists has confronted the implications of their claims about collective responsibility for defensive action against members of a corporation or citizens of a state. Now, they say a lot of things to make their to support these claims. They say, for example, that the separate actions of the individuals were unlikely to lead to any disaster in these cases in which a great harm is caused by the collective. They say the different individuals had excusing conditions of varying degrees. They say, for example, that those who are most responsible may no longer be with the corporation, they may be dead, they may be whatever, and so they're unreachable, and yet somebody has got to be charged with responsibility so that victims can be compensated. I think there's a lot to be said about these various claims. I'm not going to pursue them in detail now because I'm getting near to the time when I ought to stop, and I've got a bit more stuff that I wanted to try to get through. So they say there are these problems. People have excusing conditions. And one of them is the other claim that they made. One of them is that each person didn't have any reason to think that what he or she was doing was going to lead to a great disaster. They also make the claim that, and I'll just quote Annie Stills again, in the case of the corporation that brings about this disaster, the employees and shareholders ought to discharge a share of responsibility because they voluntarily joined the corporation. By incorporating, they gained access to a range of benefits unavailable otherwise. But gaining these benefits also means assuming liability to repair harms for which the company is responsible. I take it that this is not a claim about collective responsibility at all. It's a claim about benefiting from action that has resulted in harm. So this is, I think, completely beside the point. It's not beside the point. It's right on the point in that I think there is an important claim to be made here about benefiting from actions that have actually led to unjustified harm. Beneficiaries may be required, may have a duty to disgorge some of the benefits that they have acquired through the operation of institutions from which they've benefited. But the beneficiaries seldom coincide precisely with the membership of the collective. Sometimes members of the collective have been overall harmed by their membership in the collective, and many people outside the collective may be the primary beneficiaries. So I do think that being a beneficiary can be a basis of duties to I don't know if compensate is the right word here or not, but maybe compensate the victims of harms caused. But the beneficiaries, as I say, don't necessarily coincide with the membership of the collective. Let me conclude by saying that there is a real problem in these cases. There is something that one might be able to describe as a shortfall of responsibility. Let me quote Annie Stills again. She says, while we can attribute some liability to individuals, this does not add up to liability for the entire harm. This is because the organization of the airline, in her case, created an emergent effect that made the total harm more than the sum of the employee's intentional contributions. Well, I don't know exactly how you measure that. I think there's a lot that's wrong in that statement. One thing that's, I think, misleading in what she says there is that she's presupposing what I would call a non-comparative conception of liability, according to which the amount of harm to which an individual is liable is given by that individual's action and mental states only. So it's very much like desert rather than liability. It's like desert of criminal punishment. That's determined, on some views at any rate, not by what actually happens in the world as a result of what you do, but by what you actually do and the intentions and motives and beliefs and so on with which you did it. Whereas I think a better conception of liability is that it is comparative, so that people can engage in what we might think of as minor wrongdoing and scarcely be culpable for it at all, and yet wind up liable to pay very enormous cost. There's a nice discussion of this problem at the individual level in an old paper by Jeremy Waldron called something like Moments of Carelessness and Massive Loss, in which he discusses a case in which somebody just averts his eyes from the road for a couple of seconds, distracted by a billboard, then crashes in the back of the car in front of him, and winds up owing $5 million in compensation to somebody who's been terribly injured. And we think, $5 million for being distracted for just 1 second by a billboard? But yeah, somebody's got to absorb these costs. And if it's got to be either the victim or the causer of the harm, it probably should be the causer of the harm. And so the measure of how much harm a person or cost a person is liable to isn't just a function of the nature of what he did and the nature of his responsibility or culpability. But we could go beyond this kind of case. We might think it is actually unfair to burden this individual with all the costs of compensating the victim, given that his responsibility is low. And the problem is, in this case, we don't have some collective that we can say is responsible. But in this kind of case, what we can do is we can say, well, we can look to other means of trying to provide compensation in a way that are fair. One way would be to, for example, impose heavy fines on anybody who harmlessly engages in this kind of distracted driving or whatever, create a great pool of money on the basis of those fines, and then compensate victims out of that pool. And what that would do would be to spread the costs of compensation of victims across all the persons who engage in the kind of behavior that led to the harm in the one instance. And that seems fairer than burdening the one individual. And there are lots of other suggestions along those lines. I'm not going to go into them now. But what I think is that the tendency to think, we've got the group of people who from whom compensation can be drawn when we just think of the collective. I think that's a way of attempting to compensate victims that involves a lot of obvious injustice to individuals who haven't done anything but who get inculpated or whatever simply by membership in the collective. One other thing I would say, and then I'm going to stop, I know I've gone too long, is that often what happens legally compounds the initial injustice to individuals of holding the collective liable, and that is that in law, the legal entity is itself liable, and what it means is it has to produce the compensation, but it can decide, it there in quotation marks, it can decide how it's going to come up with the resources to pay off the claims. And what often happens is that the decision makers, the managers, the people at the top, who are the people who are really usually the ones who are responsible for whatever harm has been done, they're the ones who get to make the decision about how where the money is going to come from to pay off the claims, and so they can push the burden away from themselves onto others, because that's just all the collective entity making its decision about how it's going to come up with the money, and you know, that often compounds the injustice. I'll stop there. I've gone on too long. Thank you.